Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, and welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm joined today by Brett Durbin, one of our chaplains here on our staff, and Dr. Tricia Smith, our Director of Clinical Services here at the clinic. And today we're going to be talking about navigating seasons of singleness. Seasons of singleness. And as soon as I heard that title, you know, I don't know if it's a place you guys want to start, starting where you want, but I thought, should we, you know, talk about those seasons? In other words, are there seasons when maybe it's easier and seasons when it's harder? Seasons of singleness.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it's easier to be single when you are younger. You're not supposed to be necessarily paired up at that point. You may be dating, but you're not supposed to be married or committed.
Younger,
teenage.
Below 20.
Below 20.
Below 25.
Yeah.
And now we're starting to move into different. Yeah.
As early 20s, some people have gotten married early 20s.
Or teens even, late teens sometimes.
Late teens.
Right out of high school.
With their high school sweethearts. And, you know, they've committed their entire lives to each other. It can be harder getting into your later 20s, early 30s. And, you know, just from a female perspective, you know, they always say the biological clock is ticking, reproductive years. It could be getting into what OBGYNs call geriatric pregnancies later in your 30s. And so those concerns start setting in, I know, for at least females. And then there's the season of, you know, you have a loved one, a husband or wife who passes, and then you become single again.
Or divorce. There's another period of singleness.
Absolutely.
And I think they have different dynamics associated with them. Maybe we can unpack some of those as they go along. So navigating seasons of singleness. Do you think singleness carries a stigma?
I think it goes back to what was just defined. Depends on age. I would say my very first ministry position at a church was I was college young adults pastor. And so I was also over the singles ministry. And I can tell you that as you get into your, you know, the 20-somethings, it's not as bad. But then you get into your 30s, they feel very much that there's a stigma, you know, and the conversation is, well, the good ones are taken, you know, but then they start, it's almost self-shame. Well, then am I not one of, you know, so there's all these questions that arise. And so I think there's definitely some.
Let's unpack that group for a little bit.
Yeah. I think there's definitely some stigma that comes with that. And they put it on themselves, I think, even more than others do. But there's definitely, it comes across like shame, you know, like I should be married right now. I'm not good enough because I'm not, you know, and, you know, it's really a hard conversation because you're trying to talk to them about that. And me, I've, you know, was already married and you want to reassure them, but it's like, they don't hear it. They just keep telling themselves that, well, I must not be good enough. No one's interested in me. You know, and then it invades their whole life.
When you say I'm must not be good enough, no one's interested in me. Mm. What do you hear? And how do you respond? Do you hear that as a legitimate wrestling through difficulties, looking for answers, or do you hear that as maybe what some might call the pity pot, looking for comfort and just empathy without change?
Yeah.
Or questioning, why am I here in this season? You know, where is my, you know, princess or prince or, you know, I see all these people who have done it. Why can't I do it? It's questioning.
Yeah.
So there's multiple assumptions in the position being articulated by those in distress. One of the assumptions, something must be wrong with me. And that assumption may or may not be true. And bring me back to what you said too, because there's multiple ideas that I think could be helpful to our audience. But there's an objective question. Not that there's something wrong with you inherently in value or worth. You're a child of God. You have value and worth. But you're interested in fulfilling a role of a life partner, either husband or wife. Any life role, whether it's from a person doing burgers at a fast food establishment to the president of a company, any role you take has certain responsibilities with the role. And there's a certain skill set necessary to fulfill the role well. And so value as a human being in the image of God, there's nothing problem with that. The question is, what have you done to prepare yourself to fill the role? And some of these people I have had as patients, 29 years of old age, never went to college, living in the parents' basement, playing video games. What have you done to prepare yourself to fill the role as a husband?
Yeah, partner.
Okay, as a partner. Okay, and so when they say there's something wrong with me, not inherently with your intelligence or your capacities or your abilities or the blessings God has given you, but maybe there's something wrong with the decisions you've been making, the choices you've made. Have you developed yourself? And to just comfort somebody and encourage them, but God loves you and we love you and you're a wonderful person, and actually just colludes with the pathology. And so there's sometimes, and again, not everybody's in this position. So this is not a global statement for everybody, but there are plenty in this position where they have not actually developed themselves yet to fulfill the role. And
no.
And it may be a great blessing from God that he, if even in their childlike faith are asking his leadership, that he has not opened the door for, right, because that would collapse and fail and to be the most miserable thing. So one assumption would be the assumptions about self, ready, not ready, good, bad, whatever. Another assumption, though, is it would be better to be in a relationship than be single. That's an assumption. I will tell, and I've told many patients this, it is actually better to be single than to be married to the wrong person.
Yeah.
Do you all agree with that?
Yeah.
100% better.
Or be unstable and unable to be comfortable with self and be in a relationship.
And it's better to be single than to be an unhealthy person that hurts somebody else in a relationship. Mm-hmm. But I think of the example of Samson and Delilah. It would have been way better for him to stay single. Yes?
Yes.
No.
And there's many relationships like that. And so, these things, when you are dealing with individuals who have this restless uneasiness inside and complaint and then self-love, it's like, okay, where's it coming from? What's it about? Is it just simply the outworking of God's design, who in Eden looked in and said, in a perfect sinless world, it is not good for man to be alone. We are designed for intimate relationship, for connection and union in a special type of relationship called a marriage relationship with one man and one woman in a committed relationship where the two together become something more than either one can be by themselves. And I want to say that again. In God's design for marriage, the two together become more than either one could be by themselves. Do you understand what I mean by that?
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I, to take that thought back, though, to maybe some of the stigma or some of the even self-imposed thoughts, if you're a single person within the church definitely puts a, whether it's intentional or not, there is a higher value or, unspoken assumption that equates to maturity or fulfillment if you're married. And versus if you're not. And so if they feel that, so it's not fully respecting that single person that's totally devoted to God, which even Paul said, if you can stay single and just serve God and make him your all, well done, but for all the rest of you.
So let's unpack this a little bit more, because you're exactly right. Foundationally, there's a desire, I think, in most hearts, but because of neural diversity, some people actually don't have that same relational desire as others, whether we're talking autistic spectrum or something else. And Christ actually mentioned that when he said, some are born to be eunuchs. And he doesn't mean castrated. He means single. He means to not be in that relationship. He himself never took a spouse while he was on this earth. Okay. But in general, the vast majority of the population has still this God desire for intimacy and connection and that special type of relationship. Foundationally, then, if you want to fill that, healthy relationships, what you were saying, healthy relationships require healthy people. And so if you want a healthy marriage, and I can tell you in my own journey, there was a time I had this godly desire. And I was wanting that relationship. I didn't have it. And so I'm looking and looking and I'm dating and I'm looking and I'm looking and I'm dating and I'm praying, Lord, help me find the right woman. I don't want it the wrong way. Help me find. And this went on for years. And then one day in my journey with the Lord, I don't know exactly what the motivation, stimulated the Bible, whatever, but somehow the Holy Spirit finally got through my thick head. And I realized, and I started praying, Lord, help me become the right man for the woman you'd have me meet and be with. And I met my wife 3 months later. We've been married now 27 years. Just like, I wasn't ready. I was still too mature, too still self-referenced. The longing that I had was still godly, but it was still filtered through so much about me and not about me, my willingness to serve. Okay?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. I think that a lot of single people, they miss the point that the single season is in preparation.
That's right.
It's in preparation for being one with somebody else and dying to self to be there for another in love.
Yeah, you're building that marketability too. Well, if you think about what you said earlier, the person that's in their parents' basement, you're not marketing yourself real well when you have that conversation with someone. So yeah, I think it's two different things when you're growing and you're maturing and you're becoming a much more interesting person. Yeah, you also are going to be more attractive to someone who's also looking, you know?
Yeah, no, those are both excellent points. And so in this group, we're talking about that large group of singles in the church or not in the church, but looking, and there's something they're not at peace with. And then this message, some of the church, you know, sometimes says that somehow you're less than if you're not in that relationship,
yeah,
can be actually undermining of preparation. People rush in.
And I've even seen like Bible study groups like praying for single people's future husbands or future wives, which I think can be very loving in nature, but also cause a lot of pressure. And also, you know, younger people who are dating in the church, it's like, well, when are you going to get married? When are you going to pop the question? It's like this almost forced tension too, that becomes something that puts more pressure on it than I think it really should be. Mm-hmm. Obviously, you should have intent of who you are going to put yourself around and who you're going to be open to in a future marriage. But I think that society and the church can sometimes, in good intentions, put a lot more pressure on the single people in the church community.
And then do you want to deconstruct the other side of that argument that you can serve the Lord best if you stay single?
If you're going to have entire devotion and no distraction, I would say there's absolutely an argument for that, where you are free to follow him in any possible way he wants you to. If you don't have any, there's no family tying you down, so to speak. Now, for me personally, I can't imagine life without my family. So it's hard to like make the case for that. Yet I think biblically speaking, yes. I mean, we do see that. I think the most famous man in history that we all follow and worship was single as well. He was 100% devoted to his mission and to God. And so, yeah, I think it is a thing, but how many people, that's actually why they're staying single? I don't know. Cause there's also this whole other part of society now that it's cool to stay single. You know, why would you ever get married? Why would you want to be tied down? Usually it's guys saying this stuff, you know, that are actually horribly lonely as well, you know, but you know, why would you want to stay, you know, single? I can go out and be with this girl and be with this girl. And man, I got freedom. I have a motorcycle. I've got a sports car. I've got a boat, you know, there is this, but it's very self-focused and you wonder, is there actually any, you know, any depth there, you know, but.
No. So what you just described there is a grand lie. Because that type of relationship is built off of fear, not from love. These people who say this, they actually fear somebody getting to know them.
Yeah.
They fear intimacy. They fear having somebody come to see inside them the way they see themselves. And thus they fear rejection, fear criticism, and thus they posture in this external toys and playing and the notches in the belt of how many girls they can be with and so forth as some evidence of their value, when in fact every bit of that caused them to damage themselves, have less peace with themselves, and become more needy for the next little fix of momentary validation, because they actually live in fear of intimacy. And a true healthy godly relationship, because we come into these relationships with our own strengths and weaknesses, is a committed love relationship where you trust somebody enough to open yourself up to them and let yourself be seen. Because the great fear is, if somebody really sees me, nobody could love me. And then in that relationship, you're still loved. And then the two partners together begin counseling and supporting and encouraging and working with each other to help overcome. That's why we commit ourselves for better or for worse, for the good times and the bad, that we're going to be there to help each other over those weaknesses and things we come to the relationship with. And as partners with Christ, we use our influence to help mature our spouse. Isn't that what a godly relationship does? I know it's what my wife has done for me.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so I think the people who say that, it's a grand lie. And I think our society is suffering. And I think we're seeing a lot of problems in our society because of the undermining of godly marriage.
Yeah, I think the institution of marriage is under attack these days. I mean, people less and less people are getting married. They're just communing together. Because I think they're afraid of trusting one another. I think they're afraid of being seen. I think they're afraid of divorce. I think they're afraid of having to have the harder conflict.
Commitment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, yeah. As long as it's easy and it's fun, we'll do this. As soon as it becomes hard, I'm out of here.
Yeah. Lowest amount of accountability possible is a lot of times what's sought out now.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't want that accountability. I don't want that responsibility, but...
Yeah, or marriage is seen as a business. You know, it's a business these days. So when it's divorced, we separate our things and we separate our finances. So really, marriage is just a business.
And let me clarify that marriage as God designed is not a legal arrangement. Marriage as God designed is not a legal arrangement. It does not have state involvement. It is a commitment of two hearts in love and trust for each other. I place my heart in your hands for you to cherish, honor, protect, uplift, and same comes back. That it's a committed love. We have each other's back. We're for each other. The two become one, united in heart and mind. That is not a legal relationship. Unfortunately, when the states got involved in marriage, the governments of this world got involved in marriage. It became legal elements began to get involved. Next of kin rights, property rights, who can assign this authorization and all the legal things that go along. And that's why we've had arguments in our society of who can marry who. And my view was it was never a question. Okay, states can pass laws to make things legal in a state system-wise. States can never pass laws to make something holy and sacred. They can't do it. It's beyond their ability. And so when you understand those differences, these become, but many people enter in marriage relationships much more from the legal side of things. And if you're entering in with lots of anxieties and fears about the legal elements, then there's probably some love heart elements that need to be looked at.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. So we've talked about that season, but maybe we should talk about the season of, unless there's more that you want to clarify for those singles that are still looking.
Well, so, I mean, I know that I've heard the opposite side of, you know, the season of working on yourself. I'm not in the basement. I'm doing my own thing. Like, I have my own career. I have my own house, my own car, and, you know, I'm a catch, but I still can't find somebody, and I'm still feeling like this loss. What do you say to somebody who comes to you? I'm sure you've heard that in the young adult world. I know that you've experienced that too. What do you tell people who come to you with that, those feelings, those concerns?
I mean, I think you have to validate them first. It's a valid they're experiencing something that's real. And yet also, I think to try and encourage them that, you know, take this as a season of growth, you know, and we, it's that patience thing. It's that trusting thing, back to the trust word, you know, it's like, if we can trust that God has an ultimate plan for our lives and that we can trust in him to provide, you know, that spouse, maybe not praying in groups at church for it necessarily, but that he is in that with us, then if that is supposed to be part of our story, you know, you can trust that he will make something happen there, that you would find that person. But it's a tough conversation, because there's not an easy answer to it other than just validating that that's a very true and fair feeling that you're having. And it would be a struggle for anybody, you know. And
no, I would agree with everything you said. That the things that I would focus on is the question, not the accusation. The question is my own journey. You know, have you had the conversation with the Lord? Lord, you know, I think I'm prepared, but is there something I'm missing mm-hmm. about me that needs to be taken care of? That you know, I'm blind to. Help me see and address if there's something that I need to make an adjustment or change in. I don't know. And then the question of, do I actually trust you with this? And then another truth is the realization that, and this is one that I said already, but I can't tell you how many don't get this. It's better to be single than marry the wrong person. And so many are so, in a certain sad way, desperate to just not be alone in their singleness, that they will marry somebody even though some part of it it's not really right, and they know it's not right, but it would be better to be married to this person than to be alone. No, it would not. It would be better to wait and be alone than to marry the wrong person. I mean, how many lives you've seen really, really messed up because of a toxic marriage? Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And then if they bring kids in, it's even worse. And I've seen that. Well, I knew it wasn't right, but I thought if we had kids, it would make everything better. Kids do not heal a dysfunctional marriage. They bring lots of stress. And if you think about it, it's like a bridge that's got cracks in it, and you put more weight on it, it is not going to hold up. It's going to collapse. And that's what kids do. They put more weight on everything. And if you don't have that strength of cohesion where you can handle the weight of life already, you're already struggling, kids are just going to make it worse.
No.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, what I tell people is, you know, they often say, you know, well, when I get married, my life will start. And I tell them that your life is here now. So date yourself. Have fun with yourself. Enjoy this season.
You know what I heard when you said that? I heard a person who doesn't have a sense of identity. My life won't start till I find my part. I don't know who I am until I find that person. I need someone to fulfill me. I need someone to complete me. I'm not ret. You know, they have no sense of who they are. And if, I mean, I'm not saying that's true, but the way you phrase that, it sounded to me, the first question I'd go to, if that's the case, they're not ready for marriage. Healthy relationships require healthy people. The person who has no sense of self and is needy, they will actually be sucking away and constantly demanding the attention, the affection, the affirmation in order so they can feel good about themselves. And if they don't get it, then they become controlling and manipulative and the relationship becomes toxic. Yeah. Yeah. So other seasons, though, do we want to spend some time talking about the season of the post-divorce single? Is that a different season than the person who's just never actually got married?
Absolutely. I know in my experience, so I, you know, went through a divorce. I had a small child. And so being a mother, being single was very different than being in my early 20s. Late 20s, you know, single. You know, I had other focus. I had other responsibilities. I had already identified who I was, but you go from a partner and connected with somebody to now yourself again. And so you become unmeshed.
So I don't want to talk about you personally.
Right.
Okay. But so when I say these questions, these are not probing into your personal life.
Right.
These are questions I'm going to ask about, you know, the divorcee. In that early aftermath, at least, can there be insecurities, feeling rejected, feeling, you know, used up,
feeling, nobody will love me now. I mean, because there were lots of added levels because of the divorce of self-doubt, insecurity. If they come from a church and they've gone through their church or Christian, I'm the divorcee in the church now. People think I'm, you fair where I'm going with this.
Mm-hmm. So the stigma around singleness
after divorce. The external stigma from the community, but also one's internal condemnation, depending on the circumstances and what happened. Mm-hmm. Was I not pretty enough? Was I not manly enough? Was, why did they leave me if you're the one that they left or whatever?
Or I wasn't strong enough.
Yeah.
Or, something's wrong with me.
Yes.
So, mm-hmm.
Yes. And so could that, be a more painful time of grief, loss that, if not navigated well, could actually make one even more wounded and needy and cycle into another relationship that might even be worse than the first one.
Absolutely. I mean, obviously a breakup, depending on how toxic that breakup can be, some divorces can be pretty nasty. Some can be pretty amicable. So I think that also may have a dependence on how the person separates from that relationship.
Is there a healthy way that coming out of a divorce, it can be navigated? And I guess what I'm trying to say is, and I've seen this, that coming out of a marriage, divorcing is an opportunity. There's usually heartache, there's usually woundedness, which makes one in a place where significant growth can occur. And I've seen people who, in the aftermath, took time for deep introspection and reflection and learned some deep life lessons about self, but also about how relationships work. So as they work through the events that led to the divorce and the divorce itself, they actually become a more mature person than they were before the marriage. Have you seen that?
Yeah, I think they find out more about themselves. I think they find out more about what they don't want to accept in their life and what they want in their future.
And what was it about me that found this person attractive in the first place? Did I see warning signs that I didn't listen to because I was lonely and insecure and just would rather be with somebody rather than be alone? And I ignored those warning signs and they came home and it was a miserable life. I mean, there's lots of lessons that can be learned. And if we reflect in the aftermath of the divorce and learn those lessons, I've seen people actually become much wiser, much more mature, and much more prepared for a future relationship. Conversely, in the aftermath, if it's, well, that's hurting, that's painful, I don't want to think about that, that just makes me feel bad, then they don't learn anything, they repeat.
Yeah, I can be the person that, just dives right into the next marriage, or they convince themselves that it's not them ever.
Right. Or, the externalization, blame, they were awful, they were this, they were that, and they just, and they vilify and they run down the other person.
Yeah.
Rather than looking and say, what were my contributions? Sure, the other person had contributions, but the mature person coming out of that will look and say, yeah, they had real problems, they cheated, they did this, whatever, but what were my contributions? What did I not see? What did I miss? Was there something I missed? I've seen relationships that ended in divorce because somebody cheated, and I'm dealing with the person who didn't cheat, and sometimes there were red flags all over the place before they married him. And sometimes there weren't any. And those are different. And how you reflect and learn are completely different. One would be there were none, meaning that we're finite beings. And with all of our best assessments, we can't read the secret heart of another person. But others, when there are evidences there, I've had patients who went through a divorce after several years of physical abuse and beating from abusive husband. And when they were dating, they were getting hit.
Yeah.
And there's a lesson there. Why did you marry somebody that was hitting you while you were dating? And if they don't learn that lesson and say, what was it about me that would not recognize this and make a change? What caused me to ignore or excuse that away? And so in the period of singleness for the divorcee, I would say it's a great opportunity for personal growth, establishing your own identity, what you can learn, leaning hard on the Lord, and then being, you know, available for where he's leading.
I would also say, you know, gain support from family and from community and from friends, and, you know, open yourself up to more time with them, because you tend to go from, you know, being very just into that marriage to now you have a little bit more free time to spend with family and friends and community and pouring into yourself and your likes, your volunteer time. So utilizing those things to also come into that identity and that growth time as well.
Can we differentiate? Is there a difference between being single, alone, and loneliness? What's the difference? Because I'm going to tell you there's a difference, and want to unpack that.
Define loneliness.
Yeah, that's the loneliness, that feeling of disconnect from, I'm lonely. I don't have anyone that's close to me. I don't feel loved by people. I'm lonely.
Well, you can be in a relationship and be extremely lonely.
Thank you for that. No, I was hoping one of you would say that, because there are many lonely people in they're married, but they're lonely all the time.
Yeah.
And loneliness is not about being alone. It's a state of, and so if people have chronic, like, empty loneliness, that generally does not comport or can lead to healthy relationship.
What do you see are the key factors with?
And do you think Jesus was lonely? Do you think Jesus was lonely?
No.
But he wasn't married.
Yeah.
Elijah. Was he lonely?
I don't know.
I don't see anything that indicates that. He had a period of discouragement after the Mount Carmel experience, when his life was threatened. He got discouraged, but don't see a lot of loneliness there. So my point is, there are single people who have a healthy sense of self and are content with God's calling and are fulfilling the purpose he's called them for, often are not lonely people. They have mission, they have purpose. The lonely is often a person who is not just necessarily without people in their life, it is they don't have a sense of who they are and what their calling and purpose in life is. I think. What do you think?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Yeah. Because then they're investing in those things.
And they're trying to fill a calling or purpose, perhaps in finding meaning in someone else's eyes, rather than meaning in their, you know, calling by God.
Yeah. Or investing in their spiritual gifts that God has given to them.
Yeah.
Can you have a really strong sense of purpose and still be lonely?
So not in the way I'm defining loneliness. You can have a strong sense of purpose and fulfilling it. Well, okay. Can you have a strong sense of purpose and not be fulfilling it? Yes. And then you could be lonely.
Yeah.
Okay. So, but if you're fulfilling God's calling and purpose for your life, will you have a strong sense of loneliness? No, but you actually may have a sense of desire for the companionship God has designed still, which is not the same as loneliness. Having a desire for companionship as God designed in Eden, it's not good for man. I don't think Adam had this sense of loneliness that we're talking about. I think he actually recognized, hey, I don't have a partner.
And he had very much a sense of purpose.
Yeah. Okay, so you know, and I'm glad you asked the question, because words are symbols of ideas, yeah. And those words could be, that same word could mean something else, and so it's good to be clear in what we're trying to say here.
What about the, and this is a little bit of a different, I guess, angle to loneliness and how some people approach it, especially in the church, and I'd say this really resonates in young Christian men, that they may rush into marriage early and quick because they need to have that relationship, if you know what I mean. And I'm saying this more on a physical level.
And a physiological sexual desire.
Yes. Yeah. And which is obviously very strong in young men, you know. And so, you know, there's a lot of times you see that where, man, as soon as they find that first person, this is the one, and they're engaged for like a month or two, and then they're married, you know, and it's, well, and if you talk to him a lot of times, it's, well, we knew we were going to get married, so why wait a long time on engagement? And it's really hard to control yourself during that time, you know? And It's like, well, that's kind of almost a whole nother level of like, how, what do you say to that person? You know?
Yeah, no, that's a great, great, my conversation moves away just from the desire to, you're wanting a life partner. Yes. Tell me, what are the qualifications a life partner must have? Non-negotiable. Non-negotiable meaning any of the qualifications you list, if that one is not there, they are not qualified, even if every other one is there. So each one of them is disqualifying on their own. What is that list in your life of the qualifications your life partner must possess in order for that person to qualify to be your, for this role? And if they're still not getting it, I give an example. If your dad had a big company and he hired you to hire the new CFO, chief financial officer for the company, and you've got all these resumes, would you have a list of objective qualifications they must have in order to fulfill the role? Well, yes. Would you hire the person who simply looked the best or made you feel the best in the interview? Or would you maybe take that into account, but it would really be based on the quality? In other words, somebody who's really made you look good, but they actually, you know, dropped out of high school and failing math. But they look good and made you feel good. Would you hire them? Well, no. I say, which is more important to your life, the CFO in your dad's company or your life partner? Oh my God. So what is your list? I've never had one of these people that you've described actually have a list. Never. They've never even considered the possibility. But husband and wife roles require certain qualifications in order to fulfill them well. And each one of, now certain ones are universal. And I will give them one. I'll give you guys one and give our listening audience one that is universal. But each one of us uniquely will have some that are unique to us. That one thing, this one, I couldn't live with this. I'll give one that was unique to me. It's not unique for every human being. But I could not accept or live with somebody who was a smoker. So on my list, non-negotiable, if they're a smoker, I don't care anything. And what this means is if they had everything else on my list, but they smoked and they married me, the first thing I'm going to do in the relationship is begin to work on them to get them to quit because I can't live with that. And even if everything else is great, that person who is not convinced for themselves to quit and they want to be a smoker is going, if they give it up, they're going to resent me. I didn't accept them for who they are. That's a fracture of the law of liberty being violated and they're not free to be themselves. And the whole relationship begins to fracture on that one issue. It sets a tone of the quality. Okay. So you know the list. And if you don't know the list, you're going to marry people that are not qualified and you will each start working on each other to fix them. Whether you're doing it consciously or unconsciously. And so I would say to the person, what are the qualifications that a life partner must have? And then this is one that goes on everybody's list. It really helps in the dating process. True or false, I ask. Whomever the right person is that in God's eyes will be the right partner for you, whomever that is, they will genuinely like you for who you are. True or false, if they're qualified to be your life partner. True. It's 100% true. That's a universal one. What's the only way? I say, what's the only way you get to know whether that's true or not? By dating them and being yourself. If you date them and try to be something you think they want you to be so they'll like you, you still don't know whether they like you for who you are. You're going to live in fear that they might not like you if they know you. And you'll not know whether they're actually qualified. So you just be yourself. And then if you discover they really don't like you, you don't get your feelings hurt. You actually in your mind say, thank you for letting me know you're not qualified to be with me. But so many people live in fear of rejection that they put on pretense to pretend what they think the other one wants. They never let themselves be known in the dating process. And thus they're disingenuous and they're marrying people that are not even qualified to be with them because the person really doesn't like them.
How many people that remain single for a long period of time have way too extensive of a list?
I've never met anybody with too extensive a list. I'll be honest, never. The list is actually used. We're talking non-negotiables.
Yeah.
Okay. These are every single one of them themselves is disqualifying. Many people have things they prefer. Example, I'm a UT Vols fan. That would have been great if my wife was a UT Vols. She's a Florida Gator fan. It did not go on my list because it's not. And we have fun rooting it. So, but it would have been great if she was a Vols fan too. It would have been nice, but it was not a non-negotiable. It didn't go on the list. There's many likes that people might prefer that are not actually true non-negotiables. okay? The non-negotiables, and then back to the question you had about the sexual attraction and desire. Where does that fit? It goes on the list. One of the things on the list, for a marriage partner, there must be the chemical, physical, sexual attraction there. And I give that, I say, you know, if you have your whole list there and they like you for who they are and you want kids, and so that should be an honor. If now, some people actually don't care. Kids are fine. We don't have them. I don't care. It doesn't go on their list. Some people, it's an absolute, no way am I wanting kids, or absolute, we must have kids. For some, it's a non-negotiable. It has to go on their list, okay? That would be a unique one for people. But you've got your list and they meet them all. But then when you think about giving them a kiss, it feels like kissing your grandma or your grandpa. They are not qualified. And this is important because I've seen church members, pastors, try to hook people up. And they'll point this person out and say, they've got beautiful character. They're mature. They're like Christ. They have everything a person could want. And it might actually be true. It might actually be true that they're kind, they're loving, they're Christ-like. They have all these things. But for you to think about giving them the kiss, it feels like kissing your grandma. They're not qualified. It doesn't matter. There has to be that physical attraction there. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Okay. And so that one is usually easy to check off really fast. Usually that's pretty quick. There's some chemical... But the rest of that list, the only way you get to know is spending time with them. There's one that should be on everybody's list. You want somebody who is an honest person. As a human being, how do you check that one off? It's not just how they treat you. You're at the store with them and they get their change. And as they're walking out, they start counting their change. And they go, oh, I got an extra $5. They gave me $5 extra. You watch, what do? They walk back in and turn it in. Or they go, I just made $5. They're not qualified. They're not an honest person. Get rid of them. You don't go, well, they've never taken anything from me dishonest. If they're going to do that to them, they're going to lie to you.
Right.
They're not honest. This is how you use your list. They're not qualified. I can tell you one more from my experience, how I applied this. Back when I was dating, before I married my wife, before we got engaged, I was dating her, and I was honest and open that I am looking around. I'm dating around, dating different people, and going on a date, and a couple weeks later, but I'm dating somebody else, and there's two, her and another one I was very interested in. And I'm praying to the Lord, give me wisdom, help me see who is the qualified, and I'm thinking these things through. And with the other one, I went to a event. It was it was actually called Riverbend in Chattanooga. It's like a summer, and went with her family, and she's there with her mom, and the entire evening together, she and her mother sat there, and the entire evening was a running commentary of criticism of every person that walked by. Look at that person in those jeans. Look at how fat they are. Look at that person's beard. I bet they hadn't washed in a week, and on and on and on. Now, neither one of them said anything negative about me. It's just, I'm adorable, right? But I had if you remember the Christmas Carol, Dickens, I had the vision of the ghost of Christmas future. And if I say with this woman, it's just a matter of time till those two howitzers turn on me.
Mm-hmm.
And they start blasting all their criticisms at me. I never went out there again. I ended it. Woman I married, I was at her house with her family, and somebody else said something critical about somebody at church, and her mother always found something positive to say. I married her. Okay. This is how you use your list. And you evaluate. Now, both of the two individuals I found physically attractive, only one of them had qualifications to marry. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So this is how I counsel people like that in this time of singlehood.
Yeah. I do something similar to sum kind of all of that up. It's like, you know, the basis of any good relationship is a friendship. And you can't develop a friendship within 2 months and really know the person. And so allowing that time for that friendship and that trust to build and to really see them in their natural environment to really tell whether they're going to be a good friend, a good partner. And the only thing that's going to tell that is time.
Mm-hmm. You know, I love that because you're exactly right. My wife is my best friend in the world, 100%. I do want to so I agree with that. No, but a caveat for people, you can have many friends, real friendships, that are not good partners for marriage. Agreed?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But your partner will be your best friend.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
So do we want to just spend a minute or two on the season of singlehood in the aftermath of loss? A minute or two on that season of singlehood? Because I can come at any time. I had a young man in his 20s whose wife died. And then, of course, it's more common in the elderly. But It can come at any time. It's a different time too, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what is the, I don't have enough experience with it to know, you know, what is a, especially someone maybe that's, you know, higher in age, you know, is there advice given to go with someone else, or is it better to stay single, or is, and I'm looking at this from almost from a church standpoint, you know, what is the standard recommendation for someone that goes through that? And, or is there one, is it just very individual?
You know, well, our culture is a lot different than Bible culture. You know, Bible culture, the widow was supposed to be, you know, taken care of and married by the brother.
Yeah.
Okay. Because they had no inheritance. The social network was to not abandon them, to care for them and provide for them. But our culture is a little different.
Yeah.
I wouldn't want to have to marry my brother's widows. I mean, would you?
No.
Okay. And you wouldn't want to necessarily if you be married to your brother, your husband's brothers.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. So the Bible culture is a little different, but I think the principle, and you're asking what is the standard? I think whatever's the healthiest for that person in that season of their life. And I think, I don't have stats, so this may not, but I think it's kind of the trend that widowers tend to marry again, and widows are more likely to stay single, not exclusively, but I think there is a mathematical, you know, the men tend to get remarried and the women often don't. Do you think I'm wrong about that, or do you think there's some truth in that?
There's some truth in that.
Yeah.
I think also that you know, just because of the men tend to die before women tend to live longer. There's this kind of caretaking of mom in our culture too. There's a whole search engine that's for resources for mom after her loved one, her husband, passes away. Assisted living and support networks and all of that. It's interesting. I don't see it as much for men of widowers or widows.
Well, my father died at age 57 and my mother was 55. Pretty young in my view still. And mother never remarried. She's still alive. She's like 87 now. But typically, it's not just the grief of the loss of the person you loved you have to go through, which you do. It is, this causes a significant change in identity and life role. Living as a wife, supporting a husband, the whole dynamics of running a house and considering the other and cooking meals for that person and laundry. And my mom was a homemaker in much ways, and dad was a, you know, worker and so forth. And then suddenly all those duties are not necessary. I mean, there, nobody needs me. Who needs me? Kids are out of the home. Who needs me now? What is my purpose? Now, what's my purpose? So I think in the widower phase, there's often this question as well. I'm not only grieving, I'm a single person, and that's not who I want to be. I was a wife. I was a husband. I'm not that anymore. Who am I? There's an identity element. There's a mission. There's a purpose element. And so there's the grief, but there's also a reconnecting with the Lord and reconnecting with what's this next chapter, season? Where can I be useful in God's call? Where can I find purpose and meaning again? Sometimes it's a new relationship. Oftentimes it's not. My mother actually has always had an art desire, and she got very much into art and began teaching art and doing some of these and joined an art club and started taking trips with her friends, different places where they'd go to these places where they would paint together and things. And so, but this is an important thing, I think. It's a different dynamic than the person that were married.
Yeah, and I am looking, I mean, the thing you said, even just culturally, it is different. I look at my own parents, you know, and, you know, at some point, likely, but we can't look at the future. But, you know, when my mom is a widow, she's going to be very well taken care of. So it's not that she's without inheritance, she's without anything. So she doesn't need that someone else to come in and take care of her necessarily. But it's going to be a complete shift.
Who am I? Yeah, exactly. My mission.
I mean,
who needs me?
100% shift in life. And, you know, how do you build that purpose? You know, and she has a wonderful relationship with God. I think that's going to end up being where she finds her identity.
And so how families can help people like this would be making opportunities, not assignments, available that would necessarily fit within the scope of their skill set and callings and so forth. So particularly, like, would you like to be involved with the grandkids more? If that fits that dynamic, it doesn't fit all dynamics. We have a business. We'd love something. 2 days a week is our receptionist type thing. I mean, creating opportunities for somebody who finds this vacuum in their life now, and where they have meaning, they have something to live for, they have something to do that's valuable to them. Families can do that rather than just comfort, going over and bringing fields and bringing stuff and spending time and just visiting when the season's right. Create those opportunities for them to reengage and invest themselves in meaningful living again can be helpful for that person's singleness.
Yeah, making connection points in their life again.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we hope you've enjoyed this program today. And if you have questions, send those in to questions@designformore.net, questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.